this is how even people with 10, 20 years experience reporting on the game or just being fans of the game here in the MLS bubble come across to people who actually know football.
Right.
Right. Like this one's outrageous. This one is actually outrageous. But other people saying other things like, oh, let the kids play, or, oh, we develop robots because, you know, we don't have a soccer culture. Like all those takes that seem logical and rational, it comes across as super ignorant to people who actually know football and are in this country. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today's episode is going to be about what makes for a good coach. How do you identify whether a coach is good or not good? There's a few criteria to look out for. And luckily, in this episode anyway, those three criteria in particular are quantifiable. Yes, quantifiable. You don't have to have the eye test necessarily. So that means it's useful for everyone. I will say, though, that Benny and I, for the first 15 minutes or so, we talk about some other things, some other gold nuggets come into the picture that are not about coaching quality, but nonetheless are, in my opinion, really good stuff. So you want to stick around for that as well. Speaking about the subject matter of this podcast, if you are a coach, you want to go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium coaching education materials for you there. It is based on the work of Brian Kleiben, a pioneer here in American soccer, particularly youth soccer for over 20 years. He changed the landscape, folks. He changed the landscape. So go head on over there and you can learn from him. He's moved on to the professional level at this point, so he's starting to shake things up there as well. If you're a coach and you've been listening to us for any, I don't know, pronounced period of time, you've read a whole bunch of articles, you've listened to a whole bunch of podcasts, maybe you follow the X posts, so on and so forth, or you're on the YouTube channel, which, by the way, we just broke 6,000 subscribers, which is kind of cool. I know it's not the greatest or the biggest, but it's kind of cool. But if you're one of those coaches and you're not in the premium program, you need to get your asses in gear and get on the premium program. If you've just happened to come across us and haven't really gotten to know what we've done in the space so far, cool, no biggie, get on the free coaching education program. So both of those can be found at 343coaching.com. Same thing goes for you, parents, but for you, you go to 343masterclass.com. That is where you start your journey of becoming a quote-unquote master in the space so you can better guide your kid through this ecosystem. Last but certainly not least, if you're coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoy this show with Benny Rogers, who always does a phenomenal job here. Here we go.
Got the Pink Floyd shirt out.
Hey, people are dropping like flies, huh? Everybody's dying.
Today, Hulk Hogan, huh? Rest in peace.
Yeah, man, it's crazy. It's crazy, dude. I think I'm getting to that age where it's like my childhood heroes are all fucking starting to fall.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know what they say too, that death from like famous people or big people, it always comes in threes. So you have Ozzy Osbourne, Hulk Hogan. Let's see who's next, bro. Sad.
Yep. I think Hulk was the third one. I forgot who the first person is.
Oh, really?
Yeah, anyway, I don't know. Maybe it was somebody just too old for me to be aware of.
Yeah. Did you used to watch wrestling as a kid?
Yeah. Who didn't, dude? Fucking Hulk Hogan, Zeus. I don't know if you know who Zeus is.
Obviously I know Hulk Hogan, right? But there was like a documentary about him and it was him, Ric Flair.
Right.
The Iron Sheik.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Legends, bro. So.
Yeah. Macho Man Randy Savage, Jake the Snake Roberts. The Undertaker, Andre the Giant. It was an amazing time to be alive, dude.
Yeah. My era was more of, I think it was called WWE or WWF with The Rock and Undertaker. I remember watching that as a kid.
The redneck. Who's the bald redneck?
Oh, Steve Austin. Yeah, Steve Austin. That guy's a legend, bro. You find out that it's fake, you're like, what the fuck?
Right. Is it still going on, dude? It is, right?
Yeah, I think it is for sure.
It's just not as big.
Yeah. What's his name? The owner of it, Steve McMahon or something. There's a good documentary about like him starting it and That guy was wild, bro. He was the owner, and then he would get into the ring and fight the fighters or whatever. It was insane, bro.
Yeah. No, McMahon was kind of like the Dana White of his time, you know?
Yeah, 100%, dude.
Even, like, hardcore, didn't give a fuck, you know, played the part.
Yeah, for sure. He was the villain, bro.
But and built a massive empire from nothing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Anyways, this isn't the wrestling podcast, so we'll get into it, dude.
Okay, cool. It kind of is, because I don't know if people know that about a year ago, maybe 18 months ago or 2 years ago, I forget, MLS hired a former WWF or WWE like executive. I don't know if it was a marketing person or whoever, to be their head marketing person. So it's all kind of related, because MLS is kind of like a orchestrated sort of entertainment product.
Are you serious, bro?
Oh, yeah. I'm dead serious. 100%.
I mean, it makes sense, because you look at MLS and it kind of is. I don't want to say the matches are staged and, you know, hey, here's the script, this is going to be the score, but it kind of is just a circus, bro, a circus act.
I'm looking it up now just so that people don't have to do the work for themselves if they care to. So let's see.
Ask Rock. There was one guy, it says, Kevin Egan. He used to be an announcer for the WWE. And then he became an announcer for MLS. Shocking, bro.
No, it's a woman, dude. It's a woman. Oh, here. I found it. I found my tweet. Hold on. This is so good. Okay, let's see. Oh, it is U.S. Soccer. You're right. U.S. Soccer has hired a new chief marketing officer who will help with the federation reach its strategic vision. Catherine Newman.
That's even worse, bro.
I want to see. Let's see. Most recently, Newman was the executive vice president of marketing for the WWE. Wow. Telling you, man. Yeah. Good stuff.
That's crazy. Well, now is she still in the role, or?
I mean, probably. This is dated July 9th, 2024. So 1 year ago. Oh, I don't think anybody leaves their job after 1 year.
Yeah. That's wild, bro. I don't know, dude. I don't know what's wrong with our country. I sent you the picture of U.S. soccer. They posted a picture of Matt Priest's gloves from the quarterfinal penalty shootout. And they're like, oh, these gloves are on the way to the Soccer Hall of Fame. Like, what, bro?
So crazy.
For winning a Gold Cup quarterfinal? That's insane, bro.
It's so crazy, man. It's so disgusting, too, in my opinion, that they have bureaucrats inducted into the Soccer Hall of Fame as well. Like, literally, like, bureaucrats never kicked a ball in their life, never did a goddamn thing, actually did great work to monopolize the sport under one company. And, oh, Hall of Fame worthy. Don Garber, Hall of Fame worthy. His right-hand man, Tim Abbott, if I even remember the name correctly. Oh, Hall of Fame. And all these guys are Hall of Famers, never kicked a ball in their life. And actually, there's a track record, historical track record. You can Google it, find it, of them talking shit about soccer, because like some of these guys like Don Garber were NFL people.
Right.
And so they would literally talk shit about soccer.
Yeah, I just looked it up too. Did Don Garber ever play soccer? No, he did not play competitive soccer. Well, he played casually as a kid. His athletic background included basketball and baseball and football. So we got a guy that casually kicked the ball in his backyard and now he's running basically everything in this country.
Bro, he did not kick a ball either casually in his backyard. That they just put something in there, dude. You know, back in my day too, right when the internet was barely starting and stuff and there wasn't a lot of history, every fucking coach and their mom would say that they played pro. You know, they played in Mexico, or they played pro in Poland, or they played pro in Yugoslavia.
They did.
And there's no way of verifying this stuff. Hilarious.
Yeah. And it still happens, Gary. It still happens. Really? I can't tell you how many coaches I've come across, or I talk to parents and they're like, yeah, we just signed with a new team. Our coach played professional in El Salvador in the second division. He was there for 7 years. I'm like, oh, really? Like, have you seen any matches or anything? They're like, no, like they don't exist.
How can
you verify that stuff, bro? You know, they don't. It's insane, dude.
No, the English coaches, right, with the accent, get a bad rap here in American soccer for a variety of reasons, some good reasons, some not so good reasons. But they were guilty of this sort of stuff too. It's like, oh, you know, in England, you know, played pro fourth division. You have to understand the fourth division there in England is like better than the first division here in the United States. It's like serious stuff. And, you know, with the accent, you just, people would just bought it. And if it's, again, if it's a Mexican or Latino who also has an accent, it's like, oh yeah, he played pro in Guatemala for sure.
For sure. Well, yeah, not even in terms of the English, not even just they were professional players, but they'll say, oh, you know, I was an assistant coach of a third division pro team in England. And I mean, think about how many leagues there are, bro, that they actually have promotion relegation. So it's easy to become a professional assistant out there.
Totally. So. Totally. And how often do professional assistants get like documented online?
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't happen. So you get away with it. This stuff, the stuff is so hilarious. The scammers are out there, man.
Yeah, it's crazy, bro. It's crazy. Anyways, before we get into the actual topic of today, I think that's a good segue into what we were just talking about. Everybody's seen Messi skipping the All-Star game. There's been, I don't know, thousands of tweets that are all along the same line as what this guy said. Eric Goodman, this guy's take was the worst. He said, Messi bailing on the All-Star game is more than just a soft, annoying decision. It's a short-sighted, this is the best part, right? Reputation-threatening. Full-on diva move that shows a middle finger into the face of MLS and all its fans. Do you think Messi actually cares about his reputation or his perception to the American fans? Like, come on, guys, what are we talking about here?
Sometimes I actually don't know if these people, and this is a reporter, right? If you look at his bio,
it's
like an actual reporter, journalist, or something. First off, you know what I think of them. Secondly, this is even worse. Sometimes I don't know if they're being serious or they're doing it to get engagement. You know what I mean? Many a times I lean to the side that they're actually being serious. Especially somebody like this, because I know the tweet that you're talking about. I think it's a young guy, somebody who just kind of started out trying to report on soccer. And so if you're a young guy in your early 20s or something like that, starting off, you actually, and you don't know soccer, right? You don't know ball. You actually don't know dick. So you might actually believe that this is reputation harming to Messi.
Right. Yeah. Well, especially if you only live in the MLS bubble. And
correct.
MLS is the only exposure you have to the game. And you see Messi coming over and it's like, oh my gosh, the All-Star game. How can Messi miss this? This is the most important match of the year. This is how we get all the fans and the viewership. So if you're living in that bubble and you don't know what's going on outside of that, I can see how he's like, you know, oh my gosh, this is an outrage, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just funny.
It's related, but to a different degree. This is how even people with 10, 20 years experience reporting on the game or just being fans of the game here in the MLS bubble come across to people who actually know football.
Right.
Right. Like this one's outrageous. This one is actually outrageous. But other people saying other things like, oh, let the kids play, or, oh, we develop robots because, you know, we don't have a soccer culture. Like all those takes that seem logical and rational, it comes across as super ignorant to people who actually know football and are in this country.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty sad to see the state of where most of the media and quote unquote practitioners are in this country, because I don't think they've ever traveled out of the country or got out of their own little bubble to see what's actually happening in the rest of the world. You know, you would think that Messi coming to the U.S. would have people start researching, like, all right, where did he play before and how was the league out there? But it seems like people don't want to, I don't know, they're just stuck in their own frame of the game and everything that they've experienced in this country. So.
Yeah, well, and the MLS primary demo that they're targeting are the multi-sport fans, the general sports fan that is American.
Right.
So the fan that is an NFL fan or basketball fan or a baseball fan or a hockey fan, those are the people that they're trying to get. So you get newbies who don't know anything. And so the logic of this guy saying, oh, Messi, reputation harming by missing the All-Star game, they live in a world where it's like, oh, just like imagine if like Kobe or LeBron had scrubbed the All-Star game. Nah, I'm not going to show up. You know what I mean? Well, in that world, yeah, it can harm LeBron's reputation or Kobe's reputation because you kind of come across as a dick and being anti-fans because the fans of those leagues, like the All-Star game, you know, it's a purely entertainment sort of thing. So they take that mentality and then try to apply it to soccer and you look like a imbecile because you can't translate it to soccer because soccer is a global game. It's the same logic though, Benny, of, hey, the NBA doesn't have promotion and relegation, like, or the NFL doesn't have it, or the NHL doesn't have it. So it's the best format because those leagues are the best in the world. So that's what MLS should do. No, you imbecile. It doesn't work that way. You know?
Yeah. And it seems like, Gary, this whole concept of All-Star game, like, I don't think this happens anywhere else around the world. It's kind of like WWE, or they have WrestleMania. They get all the best people in one show and let's sell tickets for this show. Dude, in the rest of the world, this doesn't happen. You don't see a La Liga All-Star game or Premier League All-Star game. Like, no fucking chance. Dude, these teams are fighting for their lives. They don't have time to take off a week to have an All-Star break and, you know, let's have some fun. No, dude.
In the middle of the quote-unquote season, imagine La Liga, the Premier League, the Portuguese League, France, Italy, wherever, Brazil, Argentina, in the middle of the league. Okay, everybody. Okay, let's, you know, no more games. We're going to like assemble this little thing with some of the best players who we vote. The fans get to vote. The journalists get to vote. You know, the commissioner votes his favorite player into the team. And we're going to come together and play this thing. And then have a little skills challenge, you know, and maybe we'll give away some Hello Kitty things and some SpongeBob things and come before the match and we'll, you know, let you pet dogs and we'll have a little dog adoption center. Bro. And then people complain we don't have a soccer culture in the U.S. No shit. Look at what you guys enable and allow.
Yeah, bro. LAFC night. Cuddle a puppy before the game.
This is real life.
Yeah,
this is real. Oh, Gary, you don't like puppies? What kind of a human being are you? You know, like dogs? Like, shut the fuck up. That's not the point.
Oh, my God, dude. Hey, listen, the only time in Europe when a war was stopped to play soccer was literally during World War I when they took a break on Christmas Day and the soldiers came out of their trenches. Britain versus Germany, let's have a quick match and then we go back to killing each other, bro. Since then,
I've all star breaks, bro. I've heard that before, Benny. Is that a true story? I've never verified it.
Yeah, so it was on Christmas Day and literally both countries came out of the trenches, you know, put up the white flags for a day and they had a soccer match against each other, bro. Ever since then, bro, no more breaks, bro. It's just straight killing each other in the league.
Damn, so, man.
Let's go. That's a crazy story, though. No, it shows you how much football can connect people. And like, imagine in the middle of a war, this guy just killed your brother, and it's like the next day, all right, let's take a truce. It's Christmas. Let's play a game of soccer. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy. I don't want to get us off too far off track, but as I've always said, and I'll keep repeating, I'm going to repeat it now, that soccer is more than just a game. It's more than just entertainment. And not just soccer, sport in general. It's the reason it's so appealing to many of us, to all of us, frankly speaking, is because it's like a simulation of war. Competition is a simulation of war. No, people aren't getting killed, yeah? And the consequences aren't as dire, but we enjoy it because there's victors and there's the defeated and there's all the constant struggle and there's a physical component to it all. And you have to prepare for it physically and mentally. And then you have your clash and then somebody wins and somebody loses. There's something deeply genetic about it all. And that is why sports are what they are. So when folks say, oh, it's just a game, it's just for entertainment. No, it touches the core of people. And I won't dive into all this stuff, but understand, ladies and gentlemen, because I'm heated because I got a comment on YouTube that was stupid, in my opinion. Okay. They're like, oh, I kind of grew up and realized that soccer isn't that important. You know, I kind of like matured or something like that. Bro, maybe you just matured because your kid ended up not making it. So you don't give a shit about soccer anymore. But all those years, you actually did give a shit a lot about soccer. Or maybe you had a business in soccer and the business got annihilated one way or another. And the way you cope with these sorts of things is you say, soccer is just not that important anymore. It is important while it's your livelihood. You bet your fucking ass it's important. Coaches give a shit because it's your paycheck. Clubs give a shit because it's their business. Apparel companies who make jerseys and stuff give a shit because it's their business and they employ people and it's people's livelihoods. Parents of players give a shit because their kids, you know, enjoy it, have passion, want, maybe aspire to something. Maybe they aspire to play in college one day, or maybe they aspire to be on the varsity high school team one day, or maybe they aspire to be a professional one day. So you best believe it's more than just a game to those parents and to those players. It's more than just a game, ladies and gentlemen. So when I fight against the monopoly, against the corruption, against the tyranny, against the North Korea that we live in here in the United States in the soccer world, that is why it's fucking important. And parents out there, if and young coaches or whatever, if you have a kid that's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you need to be fighting for an open ecosystem, because this is the only way to open up and maximize the player pathways and maximize the coaching pathways to truly fulfilling your potential. So long as you have a monopoly owning everything and dictating to everybody what you can and cannot do, you're all fucked.
Yeah.
So it's more than just a game, Benny. Sorry. We can now begin the episode with whatever topic you've got.
Well, no, I want to go back to an earlier comment in the beginning of your rant, when you're talking about how, you know, football is, it's sometimes it's war, and although people aren't dying, you know, it's a battle and Coliseum and fighting. There's a quote that Brian would always used to say, like in the middle of the game, if like a player is going in for a 50-50 tackle, you know, or coming in from behind, this guy would be like, end his life, you know. And it's like yesterday in my training session, it was the same exact scenario. And like all the parents are right there, obviously. And I caught myself about to say, like, you know, end his life. But the sad thing is now, Gary, like a parent hears you say that and they're like, what the hell? Like Coach Benny's advocating for him to kill this guy or take his life. So it's just,
yeah,
I know you, it and if you go on our YouTube and watch some of the games, I don't know if you said it in the clips that we posted, but you'll probably hear it, bro. And as a player, you hear that from your coach. It's like, all right, like I'm going to go and get stuck in, dude.
Yeah. No, in the premium program, I bet you there's moments that during training activities or during matches where some things come out for sure.
Yeah.
That the generation, the whatever, the Zoomers or all these people might be like, oh my God, did he just say shit in a training session? Oh my God. I literally just came across 1 hour ago, Benny, another remake of, you know, that one reel where the different generations bump their arm against the side of a wall or something like that. It's so funny, bro. It's true.
Yeah, for sure. You remember Brian saying that though, no? He said that a lot.
Well, 100%. I've also remembered.
Or you remember probably said it too.
I've said all so many time, things. Dude. You remember Austin Lane?
No, Austin? I don't. It sounds familiar. Player, Austin, former player?
Yeah. He played with your older brother, Danny, outside back also. Went on to play for like an NAIA college, full ride. He was a decent player. But in one particular game, whenever, this was 15 years ago, I don't even know. Austin did something, right? And we've been training a certain thing for so forever, right? God damn, you make me want to kill myself.
Yeah, dude, the things you could say back then, dude, now you get canceled.
Folks, yeah, and folks, don't be dumb, okay? I think it was U18 or something like that at this point. You guys have to understand also what it's like around the world. This is so soft, Benny. We're so soft.
Well, dude, you even saw Pep. I think it was a year ago or maybe 2 years ago when I think they were on a streak of losing 5 games or 6 games, and the reporters are like, oh, like, how are you feeling? You know, this guy's like, I want to kill myself, or like, I want to hurt myself or something. And then the National Suicide Prevention came out against him, and he had to come out with remarks saying like, oh, I didn't mean that. And I'm sorry if I offended anybody. It's like people just take things to the next level, bro. That's just the culture out there, bro. It's not like Pep actually wants to go and slit his wrist, bro. Like, come on.
Yeah. You know? Well, hopefully the pendulum is swinging and the culture is going to go back to hard men at that point again. Like, hey, we just saw, look, we went from a Jaguar ad that was super woke, super crazy, you know, and to today or yesterday, who is it? Sydney Sweeney is doing a nice little advertising campaign with American Eagle. Okay. Looks like the culture is, the world is healing, Benny.
Yeah, that was a nice ad.
Not bad.
Yeah, not bad. I might have to go to American Eagle later, bro.
Hey, the stock popped up like 20%.
No way.
Yep.
Damn.
The world is healing, Benjamin. Good. And that means that we have a chance in soccer to actually go away from being soft to, you know, getting a little bit more serious.
Yeah, for sure. All right, dude, let's 30 minutes into the episode. Let's get into it, bro.
Go for it.
I want to, and this is along the lines of some stuff that we're already talking about, but I want to talk about, you know, the qualities of a great coach or the qualities of a great youth coach. And how can you define if a coach is actually good at player development? And I know you've written some articles on this specific topic, so maybe we can link those to the show. But in one of the articles, Gary, you say that in order for a coach to actually be good at player development, there's two non-negotiables. The first one is, does he coach a possession-based team, or is he implementing possession within his teams? And then the second one is winning, right? Does he have the results, or are his teams producing, you know, in games and tournaments and leagues? So let's start with the first one, Gary. Does a coach, and again, you say it's non-negotiable, but does a coach have to instill possession-based methodology into his teams in order to be considered good at player development in your eyes?
Yeah, you have to have that methodology, in my opinion. We have to be a little bit cautious here. If you're coaching five-year-olds, like, come on.
Right.
It's a little bit different of a thing there. Let them have fun. Let them go, run around, encourage them, cultivate the love of the game. And that cultivation of love of the game is throughout all the ages, obviously, but the emphasis shifts over time, right? So maybe once you reach U10, U11, U12, right? It's like, okay, they have the cognition at this point and they have some sort of interest in the game, more so than a five-year-old perhaps, right? If they've been playing since they were five, where you should start teaching them soccer, right? And what is soccer? Soccer is a team game. Soccer is not an individual game. It is not a player's game. It is a team game. So you have to teach them how to play within the context of the team. Now, how do you do that? Well, what maximizes development, Benny, is if a player on your team gets a lot of touches, number one. Forget training. I'm talking about an actual match, okay? So in an actual match, when are you developing most? When you get a lot of touches and when you have a sufficient understanding to assess the situation and make decisions on what is a right and wrong decision. Okay, so let's talk about those two things. The first one, maximize touches in a game. If you are playing random soccer, where it's not orchestrated at all, it's not possession-based, it's just two teams doing whatever the hell they want, every player does whatever the hell they want, it many a times just turns into what I coined jungle ball many years ago, where the ball is just flying all over the place randomly, it's in the air, it's on the ground, it's going out of bounds, there's no structure, there's no strings of passes being connected, long balls all over the place. When you look at those games, each player on the field does not get as many touches as if it is controlled, orchestrated, possession-based with a lot of passing sequences occurring or strings of passes occurring. And then it's the quality of the touches that you get too. In the jungle ball circumstance, what types of balls are coming to you? Disgusting balls, uncontrolled balls, things of that nature. And when you are not a pro, for instance, that's not great for development. You want consistent, high quality passes towards your reception opportunities to receive. So in a structured possession-based game, you get that as well. And you get more touches. And then what happens once you get the ball? Once you get the ball, what does a player do? A player has a decision to make on their hands. Do I dribble? Do I one touch it? Do I stop it? Assess my situation? You know, do I go to my left back? Do I go to my right back? Do I go forward? Do I go backwards? Do I launch it forward? Like, there's all these scenarios that they have to assess. In a possession-based environment, you have trained them to, one, understand how football is played, and it's not something random. So the decision space gets reduced to like, hey, if you are the right back, these are generally 90% of the time, the three or four decisions that you're usually going to be making in a game. So before you get the ball, look at those four scenarios already. And then once you get the ball, make a decision on which one of those four scenarios you want to execute. And then you get to see the consequences of whether you made the right decision or the wrong decision, right? In a random chaotic mess, a non-possession based training or methodology or game, none of that happens either. So there is no development. In the end, it just turns into a pickup game. So that's kind of scratching the superficial reasons as to why you must have a possession-based methodology as a coach.
So let's look at, for example, Gary, like a Mourinho. Obviously, Mourinho's not a youth coach, okay? But Mourinho in the past has been described as, you know, a counter-attacking coach, extremely well-organized defensively. If a youth coach does this, Gary, I mean, obviously, you look at Mourinho, and are you going to say that Mourinho doesn't develop players? I think, of course, he does. But it's not a possession-based team. So is there anything wrong with having a system or a philosophy like that? I mean, look at the success that Mourinho has had.
Yeah. So many strings we can pull on here. If we're talking about the youth level, should a coach teach their players how to maybe bunker or be defensive in a low or mid block, as they say, wait for the opponent to make a mistake or try to incite the opponent to make a mistake and then counterattack? Yes, coaches should do that. Okay. Should it be the core of their philosophy where that is what their team does every single match? That's dumb, because you have just eliminated what I went on a rant on as to maximizing a player's number of touches in a match. Well, you aren't going to maximize your number of touches if you relinquish possession to the other team. You're going to minimize the amount of touches that you get, which is not good for possession. And then once your team gets possession, if you are going to counterattack, like in your Mourinho example, great. That's an important component, but again, you're minimizing the amount of touches on your team. So if you counterattack, that's usually like a long ball, or maybe just two or three passes maximum, and you're already in the opponent's offensive third with something coming out of it or nothing coming out of it. So every possession that your team has is only two or three touches, and you've lost it again. That is not development, Ben. So when should a coach do these sorts of things like a Mourinho? When you assess that your opponent, their roster is vastly superior to yours, and you know that you are not going to be able to have possession on them. Like, you know for a fact, like it's just not going to happen. Then you're like, okay, kids, this is usually what is done in soccer, right? You deploy this tactic. That's a teaching moment, but it's not development all the time.
Yeah, you park the bus. And I think that's a big part of being a successful coach and really being able to recognize, you know, when this is going to have to occur, because a lot of coaches that do possession-based teams, even when they play teams that they know are going to be better than them, they don't adjust or they don't change their game plan or the way that they're going to press the other team. They just stick to their guns. And I think if you look back on some of Brian's games, and especially when his teams were playing up in age groups, There was games where clearly the other team was more technical, you know, bigger, faster, stronger. And in those instances, he really had to adjust. But if you don't do that, then you're going to get exposed. You know, you try to build out, immediately the other team wins possession, and it's just going to be a nightmare of a game. So adjusting your game plan is huge, especially at the young ages.
Yeah. The like you said, the challenge is does the coach have sufficient discernment to know when to do that and when not to do that? Because I understand the temptation. I've been on the sidelines, obviously. And many a times the temptation is to not be brave and courageous and try, right, to possess. And you too quickly fold and you're like, oh, the other team's like too good, but they actually aren't that good, Benny. They actually aren't that superior to you. And you should try to possess and you should try to dominate with the ball. And don't chicken shit out. It's supposed to happen when you are 100% convinced and you know what you're talking about. You're like, there's no fucking way. So I am going to bunker. For example, the most recent case, and this is something that people can look up because I think the game, you can still stream it if you go to ESPN Plus or wherever it is. It was when Brian's third division professional team, AV Alta, which he is the head coach of in USL League One, had to go and play FC Dallas, an MLS team, in Dallas. And, you know, on paper, it's kind of like, there's no effing way. There's no effing way. Like, Brian is completely pound for pound, player for player, outrageously outmatched. There's just no way. It's equivalent to saying if FC Dallas has to go play Real Madrid in Real Madrid for the most part, okay? But Brian, in my estimation, biases aside, has a certain level of mastery with a possession-based methodology and a certain level of charisma with his players that it was clear in the game. He's like, nah, I'm not bunkering. I am going to try to dominate possession. And the end result was, yeah, he lost the game, but it was a 50-50 split in possession and he outshot FC Dallas. So that I think I've gotten the point across, right? Don't chicken out too easily.
Yeah. The other thing too is Gary is like situational game awareness. I mean, you went to my high school final. We're up 1-0. For me personally, I was trying to push to go and get the second goal. And now looking back with like 15, 10 minutes left, I'm like, fuck, dude, should I have bunkered down and dropped 11 players behind the ball? You know, I still, you know, that those decisions keep me up at night, bro. So you have to have the situational awareness of, dude, it's 1-0. It's a final. Drop everybody behind the ball. Smash everything out, dude.
Benny, I remember this like it was yesterday. Speaking of how impactful those moments are and they stay with you for a long time. OSC Rage, okay? It was U16 and we were playing in National Cup, right? Back when National Cup was the most important thing in the entire country, okay? I think it was quarterfinal or something. And I believe it was out in Lancaster. We were playing against a premier team, Arsenal FC, which is out of the Inland Empire, out of the Riverside sort of area. And Arsenal FC was probably the second or third top five best U16s in the entire country, right? And Brian had this rinky-dinky U16 silver elite team, which is like two or three tiers down. Like, who are you? We go up 1-0, and we just kept going. And we ended up losing the game 2-1, or I think it was 1-1. We lost in PKs. I don't remember exactly how it went. We lost the game, okay? But we were up 1-0. And to this day, I just remember our chats after the game and the weeks later. We made a conscious decision of like, okay, we have to have kind of like written down already what is our game plan under certain scoring scenarios.
Yeah.
Right, when we're up against that. So if we're up 1-0, okay, we're going to 3-5-2, right? Or like that is actually the lineup we were thinking of. Okay, if that happens again, we're going to 3-5-2, but with the outside guys in the line of five, like it's basically like 5-3-2 sort of thing, or a 4-5-1 or something like that, and go ultra defensive, just lock it down, and end the story. And we started doing that.
Yeah, or if you're down, I remember you guys always went to 3-4-3. I mean, get numbers up. But no, Gary, this is the game where they scored off a throw-in, no?
Was it a throw-in? Maybe did we give them a PK or something?
I don't know if you remember that when I told you this in an earlier podcast, but it was in Lancaster. Rage was winning 1-0. And I was a little kid on the side and the ball goes out of bounds. And like I sprinted to get the ball to like throw it to the other team. And these fools scored a goal. Dude. I felt horrible, bro. And then because
I don't remember.
That was a game to like determine if they go to Hawaii or something like that. But I did. I felt
that could have been the one, Benny. Maybe it's all your fault. We should have put in the script also. We change our formation and all our ball boys, like, you're not allowed around the field.
Dude, I felt like an idiot, bro. I'm like, dude, if I would have just let the other guy from the other team go get the ball, give Brian Steen more time to set up defensively.
It was towards the end of the game. It was one of the last plays of the game.
Yeah, dude. I wanted to cry, bro. Oh, man. Crazy. Anyways, okay, so possession-based methodology, Gary. What's the eye test? Like, if you're a parent or you're just a fan and you're going and watching a game, a lot of people like to claim, oh, my team plays possession. You know, they'll post a clip of 1 7-pass sequence, Gary, from the entire game, but the rest of the game is kind of completely random. First of all, what's the minimum number of passes that you want to look for and how many times? So for example, like 5-pass sequences or 7-pass sequences, and how often should it be occurring in the game?
Yeah, I think it also depends on age and level of play. Because if I say, oh, just go and see if there's at least a 5-pass sequence that happens 10 times in a match, and people are going to watch an MLS Academy play, well, yeah, you're going to see that happen, right? And then, you know, the criteria for are you actually a possession-based team changes, because I'll go and watch an MLS Academy play. It's shockingly bad, Benny. It's not possession because it's not really orchestrated and it's garbage and trash, but that's a whole other layer to discernment. But if you're starting young, right, you go watch a random U11 game, and you're going to have to inform me because you're out in the fields every weekend still, as opposed to me. You go watch a random U11 match. Seeing a 5-pass sequence is kind of rare, probably. And seeing at a minimum a 5-pass sequence, maybe 7 times in an entire match or 10 times in an entire match, probably doesn't happen. Maybe it's 1 in 100. I don't know what the statistics are. I'm just going off of my personal experience from years ago. So that is what parents should be looking at that sort of level. And then it progressively, those numbers should be increasing with age and should be increasing with level of play as well. So maybe at U14, you should be seeing 10 pass sequences, stringing 10 passes together, maybe 3 times in a whole match, maybe four times in a whole, that 10 pass sequence is no joke. That's like real possession at that point. And then as you go even higher, Benny, it's like, okay, where are those sequences happening? Are they happening only between the back four, you know, under no pressure whatsoever? That's one thing. Are they happening in the opponent's half? If you have a 10 pass sequence in the opponent's half and the opponent is kind of trying to pressure you, wow, okay, there might be something going on there.
Yeah. And especially, Gary, if, like, for example, because we always say it, like, teams are sandbagging, right? But if you're a flight one team and you're playing against a flight two or a flight three, your team better be having a 15 or 20 pass sequence. It shouldn't be 5, 6, 7, you lose possession. And you know what I mean? If you're completely outmatching the other team in higher quality, then yeah, you should be keeping way more possession, you know?
Totally. That's another metric. That good point, Benny, is you also have to judge the relative strength of the rosters. So if roster A is way better than roster B, and then roster A is showing some of these passing sequences, then it still might not be a possession-based team with a great coach doing possession-based methodology, because naturally, by nature alone, that'll happen.
Yeah.
You know, so then you can have an MLS team scrimmage against a college team or something like that, and the MLS team might be shocking, terrible. They're bunker and counter. They don't give a shit about possession, but naturally they're going to possess the ball because they're so far superior, and vice versa. Vice versa. Here's another thing. If you're, in your estimation, team B, which is worse than team A, team B is having these passing sequences against a superior opponent, strong signal that there's something good going on with that coach and that team.
So the second metric, Gary, is obviously winning. I know we talked about this topic a lot, where we say, you know, winning doesn't always equate to development. Because what you'll see a lot of times, Gary, is especially in the youth ages, and we bring this up a lot, most teams have two or three man-childs that completely take over the game. So a team can go the entire game without having any of these passing sequences that we just described and still win 7-0, 8-0, 9-0. But does that mean that the coach is developing the players? You know, so how can you define winning as a metric of, is this coach actually developing my players? And the other thing that happens, Gary, is some coaches aren't really good at developing players, but what they are good at is recruiting and bringing in new players to the team. And, oh, here's another mega crack. I'm going to bring him on my team. And all of a sudden, my team is now winning every single game. We win every tournament. But, you know, you can get a grandma off the street with the same players, and she doesn't have to say one word, and the team is still going to win every single game, you know? So
yeah.
So sometimes it's hard to discern, is this coach actually developing the players, or are the kids just, you know, naturally good?
100%, Ben, 100%. That's why it's difficult.
Yeah.
And that's why there's so much confusion in the marketplace as to who is good, who is not good, all that sort of stuff.
Because even on the other end of the spectrum, Gary, you can have a coach that's really good at developing players and they are playing a possession system, but they're not winning games then. They're not winning tournaments. So,
correct.
You know, there's both sides of the coin.
I would say that particular scenario you painted, the coach, if they're good, they just need more time.
Yeah.
And secondly, sometimes you're just outclassed and outmatched, you know, in whatever competitive circuit you happen to be in. Maybe you have literally the worst roster in the entire league that you happen to be in. And then you're in trouble. Like, you could have Pep Guardiola himself come and coach the team, and he's not going to win the title. You know,
yeah.
He'll probably do a great job with possession and development and for that level of player, but he's going to get that booty spanked. This is just reality. But over the course of time, that coach should start becoming a winning coach. Because if he doesn't become a winning coach, that means I'm speaking generally here, okay? Exceptions aside, and I know everybody thinks that they're an exception. Please, guys, don't think you're an exception to the rule, because it's called the exception for a reason. You should become a winning coach eventually, because even after this season, you should have been scouting and you should try to recruit better players so that you can actually compete in the competitive circuit that you're in. And you should do that, because that will further enhance and improve your team, which will further enhance and improve the other players on your roster as well, which will further enhance and improve development for those players. Yes, you're going to have to cut some players. The bottom end of the roster, it's probably best if they go and play somewhere else. But as the season cycle out, that coach who's doing the right things in training and doing the recruiting will eventually become a winning coach. So you get the two ingredients there side by side.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight, Gary. People think that you train your team this way for 2 months, 3 months, and all of a sudden you're going to win every tournament. It takes time. It's daily process, you know, every single day. And it takes a lot, bro. You know, but like you said, too, I think that's another important ingredient is continuing to strengthen your roster. And, you know, sadly, you know, sometimes players just aren't cutting it, and it's better for their development to be placed within another team, you know. But so aside, Gary, from possession, aside from winning, we're talking about obviously what makes a great coach, what makes, you know, the quality of the coach in terms of developing players. How important is the ingredient of you mentioned this before, the personality of the coach, or the charisma that he carries and the passion, right? Because you can be extremely successful in teaching possession and teaching your kids how to play. You can win, right? But if you don't have the personality or the passion, eventually the players aren't going to want to play for you. You know, they're going to go somewhere else. So how important is that ingredient?
I think it's huge, Benny, because you can't squeeze the orange of potential to its fullest from every player.
Right.
If you don't have charisma, if you don't have that connection with the players, where the players want to run through a wall for you, that they will go to war for you, that they will bleed for you, that they will make sacrifices for you. If you are not that, don't have that charisma, then you might deploy the possession-based methodology. You might get your team to start stringing passes together, like we said. You might even win, but you're still operating at 70% of what you could be operating at. And your players are only getting 70% of their potential fulfilled while they're with you instead of 80, 90, or 100%. So it's that extra mile of charisma. And unfortunately, I don't know, Benny, if that can be developed in a person, if that can be developed in a coach. I want to be optimistic, glass half full, and say that, yes, coaches can get better in that department. And the way to get better in that department is twofold. One, you have to want to get better in that department. You have to want to be able to change your personality a little bit one way or another. And then two, I think the active ingredient is mastery of your craft. So if you truly master your craft or have that breeds supremely high confidence when you go to teach this craft. And with that supreme high confidence, it's contagious, right? The players will sense it. And then that's charisma. They'll be like, wow, Benny knows what the fuck he's talking about. This is incredible. Like, I am going to follow this man because he knows what he's talking about. And if he knows what he's talking about, then he knows what is good for me. So I'm going to do what he says.
Yeah. The more you know, the more you flow.
Yeah, that's good. Honestly. Pretty good. I'm going to steal that.
No, hey, but I mean...
But a lot of it might just be hard-coded in people. Some people are just super introverts and they can't change. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you look at it like an example that I like to use is, you know, teaching communication to the players, right? When you get a really quiet kid, and obviously we all know that communication on the field is massively important, and you try it instilling it in them, you know, you're getting on them in the rondos and in the games, telling them to talk, and maybe they'll talk for, you know, the first minute after you tell them that, but then they resort back to their little shell and are just quiet. I mean, 90% of the times, those kids don't change. All of a sudden, they don't just change their personality and start screaming at other players on the field and, you know, demanding. And especially as you get older, I think it becomes even harder to change your personality and your way of living, you know? But I don't know. I'm sure there's been research done, Gary, is can you change your personality? Can you change the charisma that you have? But it's interesting, bro, because I played for some coaches, Gary, that were just, I don't know, the best word to describe them is boring. And so you kind of lose interest in the game, lose interest in the team. This guy's going on a massive rant and you're thinking about something else completely different, right? I remember when playing for Brian, right? Anything that this guy said, not only myself, but all my teammates, your eyes are glued to him. You want to know what he's saying. You can tell he knows what he's talking about. So I think the personality is huge too.
And the other ingredient is you have to care, because you can't fake caring. Yeah. Yeah. You can't fake it. People know whether you actually care about them or just talking.
Right. Yeah. When you say care, Gary, you're talking about like the individual relationship with the player.
Like,
right?
I care, like I care about you, Benny. I love you, Benny. I want what's best for you, Benny. It needs to be real.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. Appreciate that.
You know what I mean? Because I think that
I think that
is a significant piece of Brian's charisma. He actually cares about you.
Yeah. Do you think that has to do with your background, Gary, and how you were raised, or what do you think it is?
I don't know, Ben. That's,
or is it just some people, and not even just about caring. I'm talking about, you know, the charisma, the personality. You know, do some people just have it and others don't? Or is it a trait that needs to be learned? I don't know, dude. It's interesting.
I don't know. It's the nature versus nurture conundrum.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I've seen people who you would think are like introverted and reserved and stuff. And I have seen them blossom. And I'm talking outside of the soccer environment as well. You know, right. You see them blossom. And usually the common element, if I may venture to say this, is that they become very competent, supremely competent in their craft. And with that comes confidence. And with that wants, there's sometimes a desire to teach. And when you have an authentic desire to teach, that means that you actually care about the recipient learning because you think it's good for the recipient, overall, right? It's a good thing for them to learn the things that I have to teach you. So that's what leads to the caring also.
Yeah. And for coaches, it's hard, Gary, because I think the best coaches are the ones that truly love the game. But as a coach, it's easy to become jaded by the system, jaded by the amount of pay that you're getting. It's like, dude, I'm only getting X amount of dollars every month. And look at how much work I'm putting into it, bro. You know, so why am I going to continue going the extra mile or doing all this extra stuff, dude? It's hard, bro. You know, because that point, it's like, okay, do I need to get another job? Do I need to spend my energy and my resources here? You know, so if you're not passionate about the game, those are the coaches that just die out within a year, 2 years, because you look at everything going on and it's like, why am I putting in all this work, bro? For what?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And understand, it's a good point. And understand, I hate pointing the finger at parents at times, but we have to talk about these things, right? If you as a parent, or you see parents talking shit about the coach or giving the coaches a hard time or saying, oh, they only care about the money, or saying, oh, they don't give a shit about the players, you know, all the classic things, you are contributing towards your particular coach of your kid getting to the point where they're jaded with their team and you. And eventually it's like, why the coach is going to be like, fuck this. Why I care so much. Why am I caring so much? Like, fuck these people, you know, or fuck this team. And they might be get jaded enough to the point where they become what you accuse them of being, right? So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. And the other thing too, Gary, is we talk about this a lot, like sideline coaching of the parents. Like what I had a tournament this past weekend and I was walking up to my field, but obviously there's other fields going on. And every field that I walk past, you hear a dad or a mom giving like specific instructions, and you see the coach on the sideline just like shaking his head, like, what are you guys doing? You know, and it's, I think you said this or somebody else said this, like, no, in no other profession do you have other people coming in and telling you how you should be running it or giving advice to, you know, your employees or your players. As a coach, that's, I can't think of any, like, imagine if you're a cop, Gary, and somebody comes up to you and says like, oh no, you should be arresting this guy this way, or you're a heart surgeon and it's like, oh no, you're
doing it wrong.
Hit it long, you know, cut the vein long, or you know what I'm saying? Like, what other profession do you have to deal with that type of shit? I read
in an article once that you're supposed to cut the artery horizontally, not the way that you're doing it. Like, just Jesus Christ.
Yeah, dude. So, I mean, that's another thing that it's frustrating for coaches, you know, and even if you have the parent meetings, you say, hey, you know, no sideline coaching, you just sit, enjoy the game, support your kid. They're never going to stop, bro. There's some parents that just never stop, bro. And if they don't stop, and even if you send them to another team, it continues at the next team too. So it's just never ending, bro. That's why for parents, dude, I mean, like I was talking with my coaching colleague the other day who also has a son who's like 2 or 3, and we're looking at the parents on the other side, and we're like, oh man, that I can't wait for that to be us soon, just chilling, saying nothing, bro, you know, hydro flask with, you know, some Chardonnay maybe.
Oh, good times, man. I can't wait to see you on the sidelines, man. See how you handle yourself.
I'm not saying anything. Benny,
what if your son's coach is a bumbling idiot? Like, what do you do?
I wouldn't have him on that team. I already told you.
Because you as a coach are going to be able to know.
I already told you. I'm taking my kid to a Mexican league with a mean-ass coach that doesn't speak any English, and just let him have it, dude.
Got it. Let him get into the Mexican brawls at halftime or after the game.
100%, dude.
I love that, man. I love it.
Yeah, bro. I mean,
hey, I wanted to mention one thing before I forget on the possession based thing, because I know this comes up often, so it needs to be addressed. Oh well, Gary, coaches who do this stuff, you're killing the creativity of players. No, we are not. It's the exact opposite. You are giving the players a framework from whence to express their creativity, and it maximizes their creativity because you're going to get more touches than before, and you're going to get more space and time than before, and you're going to get a solution space that is that you're aware of, right? And then you can express yourself as a player as much as you like. Do we put in restrictions like, hey, if you're a center back and you're in your own 18-yard box with the opponent is all in there, high pressure situation, you're all like, who knows what's going to happen? There's danger. Do we let the center back try to meg the player inside there and do a rainbow and then get out? No, of course not, because that's retarded and stupid. Okay, you're teaching the players wrong things. That is not the location to be, quote unquote, creative. That is a classic case of launch the ball wherever the fuck you can. Get it the fuck out of danger. That is the correct thing to do. Now, if you are in the offensive third or in the opponent's half and you're a winger or you're an outside back and you're attacking, you know, with the ball, be as creative as you want. You want to try and meg somebody or something like this? You want to try fancy tricks? Great. Knock your socks off, okay? But there is a right, don't do it all the time, because you also have to teach the kid that. You're not supposed to do it all the time. Do you see Messi doing it all the time? No. Yeah. Oh, Gary, that's the pro level. Yeah. Please understand that a possession-based methodology coupled with what I just described enables creativity to flourish and develop.
Yeah.
Random jungle ball all over the place, disorganization all over the place is the opposite of creativity.
Yeah, I mean, look,
and by the way, I'll end with this one more thing. Where you are supposed to develop your creativity anyway is not in the team club competitive circuit. You're supposed to develop it on your own, playing pickup soccer. And if you're not playing pickup soccer, guess what? You're not going to be a creative player no matter what.
Yeah.
You're not going to be Neymar or a Brazilian or an Argentine or a French. You are not going to be a creative player if you're not playing pickup soccer. I don't care if your coach lets you do whatever the heck you want to do on match day, okay? You're not getting enough matches or enough experience to be a creative player. You will not be a creative player.
Yeah. Gary, look at Lamine Yamal. I'm pretty sure he spent his whole career in La Masia, right? In his youth days. Mm-hmm. This guy's the furthest thing possible from a robot. And he grew up in a system of possession-based methodology. You know, so yes. Anybody that says, oh, you know, you're creating robots or you're stifling their creativity. How is it that the best player in the world right now, 17 years old, shows massive creativity on the field, is insanely good at 1v1, insanely good at dribbling, but he was in a possession-based system. So how is that possible?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
No, it's what we say in this country is the exact opposite of the truth. For the most part, if you get mainstream narratives and you write out the narrative, whether it be a sentence, a paragraph, an entire article, if you rewrite it with the exact opposite of what they're saying, that is actually closer to reality and the truth than what was. I'm being literal here. You literally go out and do that, and you will be closer to the truth.
Say it one more time.
So go and find any mainstream article, any mainstream narrative that exists. Oh, here's one. In the U.S., we develop robots because they are overcoached. Okay, that's actually completely incorrect and completely the opposite. Rewrite that sentence. Say, in this country, we develop robots because they are not coached or not being coached or under coached. That is closer to the truth, literally closer to the truth. Ben, and just as it's not proof because people maybe haven't been a practitioner, haven't been around as long as I have, right? On the fields, working the space, seeing everything around the country, around the globe. In the United States, for the past decades, I'm talking the 80s when I was playing, right? The 80s, the 90s, yeah? And then late 90s, I even started coaching or something. 80s, 90s, 2000s, just take those three decades there. Youth soccer in America, the teams had zero coaching, basically. Zero coaching. There were no tactics. There were no nothing. It was kind of like you show up to practice, you do some fitness stuff, and then you like scrimmage. Half the training was scrimmage, okay? And the scrimmage was not one touch restricted or two touches or nothing. It was free play. It was pickup soccer, Ben, okay? That's how it's been in youth soccer for those three decades, 80s, 90s, 2000s. And I'm leaving out 2010 and 2020, but it is still true, 100%. That is what we have been doing. What people advocate for, like let the kids play, too much coaching, too much tactical stuff, that is literally what the United States has been doing for decades. And the result of it is you get what you see on the national team, what you see in MLS, you see robots, you see uncreative players, because we have been letting the kids just do whatever.
Yeah, dude, we need more environments for those type of actual moments where you can literally just let the kids play, like futsal, pickup soccer, I don't know, two or three times outside of the team environment. And then within the training environment, you're learning all these things, but that doesn't really exist in this country.
It does in small pockets, in the Latino pockets and in those sorts of things. Because Ben,
yeah.
I think yes, the most recent, last 5-6 years or something with the iPhones and social media and all that stuff, yes, less and less kids are getting outside and more are just stuck to the screen, but that's a global phenomenon, not just the America, okay?
Yeah.
But during the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, you could go to parks here in Southern California and there were kids and people playing pickup. Yeah. I know, even when I was going to college, I would skip on my classes. I wouldn't show up to class because I'd be driving and I'd see a pickup game happening on the sidelines, right? 7v7, 5v5, Mexicans, whatever. And I'm like, I'm just gonna play. And I'd just pull over and go into a pickup game and I'd fuck off my class.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't see it that much anymore. It's sad.
But it was there is my point. You know?
No,
so people
sure.
are like, oh, play, the reason we suck here is because we don't play. Guys, there were freaking massive pickup games happening all over the place.
Yeah.
And look, even when you were young and playing, you've said it on this podcast many a times. You would go to the La Habra Boys Center, whatever the heck it was called, you know, afternoons and evenings and nights, and there'd be pickup games happening one after the other, after the other, after the other. And sometimes I would show up and Brian would show up and we'd get in on some games as well.
And not only does it help your development, Gary, but for me, like those are the most fun times I had as a kid, bro. Like those games, those environments, that competitive nature, win or get off the field. Like I used to love going to those things, dude.
It's the best, man. It's the best. Maybe we should try it again. I just don't think it's going to work. And maybe it's a waste of time because we kind of tried it, but I think we've learned enough lessons to maybe try it better. And we set up pickup games again, but we have to make it kind of organized and structured and, you know what I mean? Kind of like, like a pay-to-play pickup thing, but everybody, all the parents, everybody have to understand the rules, right? It's pay-to-play pickup, but you might drop off your kid and he might only get into one game in 2 hours because maybe nobody picked him to be on their team. And once he got on, no, I swear to God, but that's part of it. But bro, that's part of it.
Can you imagine, bro, the soft parents coming to you out there like, Gary, I just paid $15. Nobody picked my kid. He sat there for 2 hours.
It's part of it, man. Terms of service. Here's the contract.
Yeah. Well, I remember when you guys did that before. Right, didn't you have a parent come up to you after and said like, hey, what the hell, Gary? Like, nobody coached my kid. Nobody was giving him advice or something like that.
Totally. Totally. You thought you guys were going to be coaching them, doing drills. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
No, or your kid might get into a game and they get eliminated right away. The pickup game might last 40 seconds, Benny. The other team scored and you're out. And that's it. That was your whole experience for 2 hours. Eat it. And then there's the other extreme where the cracks kind of banded together and they have a superstar team of 5 cracks and they played every game for 2 hours straight.
Yeah. Or after an hour and a half, they're like, all right, we're going to lose on purpose and take a little break then. But
all kinds of things happen in that environment. It's the best, man. It is the best, Benny. It's the best.
I'm curious.
But here's the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen. The players, your kid, whoever it is that you're thinking about, the United States player pool as a whole, you are not going to be a creative player if you don't play pickup and you aren't playing on the street. It ain't gonna happen.
Yeah, I'm curious.
It's not a coach's fault. It's not a club's fault. It's not a league's fault. It's not the system's fault. You are not going to be a creative player if you aren't out there on the streets playing.
Yeah, like what I brought up my example, Gary, of Lee Mall. Obviously, he spent his whole childhood basically in La Masia. I'm curious if they allow them to go out and play pickup, or if they organize their own. Like, how do you think countries across the world, especially like youth academies, do they just let their kids go and play, or do they organize it themselves? Or I'm curious.
I'm not there, and I don't work there, Benny. All I can say is the reality of everybody's story, whether I meet them in person or whether it's not in person and just through other people, or I'm just reading from their own testimony, their own biographies, or their own interviews. They play, Benny. Whether their academy or club allows it or doesn't allow it, they don't give a shit. They're on the streets playing.
Yes. No, for sure. You remember Billy Bizarro, no?
Yeah, of course.
So he went to Legends, and he started this whole thing. You know, do you know Silver Lakes? The massive.
Yeah, of course.
So within Silver Lakes, they built like, I don't know, 3 or 4 like nice futsal courts. And, you know, Billy started this whole futsal program where it's just open to all the kids to come and play. And I think we need more of that, dude. You know, not as much structure. Allow the kids to just show up, you know, drop their bags, play. I think this country needs more of that.
Yeah, but you need a business model to sustain it, though, Ben. There has to be a business behind it.
No, I'm sure they do, dude, because they have. Yeah. I think they started teams and stuff like that within their own club players and, you know, extra stuff. But
perfect. If ultra wealthy, ultra high net worth people are in our audience and you want to do something like that, well, it has to make sense for everybody, but you've got willing partners here that with a network, maybe we can make that happen.
Yeah.
You put up the money, we put in the legwork, we have ourselves a business and we bring it to life.
For sure. That'd be sick, dude. All right, brother. Good stuff, man.
All right.
Rest in peace, Hulk Hogan.
Poor Hulk.
Ozzy Osbourne. That one came out of nowhere, dude. I didn't even know he was sick or anything.
Yeah. Well, they were in their 70s, weren't they?
Both of them. Yeah, but dude, you look at Ozzy Osbourne, dude, then that guy took more drugs than the whole country of Colombia probably did. He went on record saying like, dude, I should have died like 100 times, but you know, here I am still.
What a life, man, huh?
Yeah, seriously. Legend. All right, brother.
All right, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll be in Irvine tomorrow. I'm actually going to recruit a team at 9 a.m. at the Great Park, and then I'll shoot right over.
Okay, perfect. Even better.
Yeah. Yep. All right, dude.
Later, Benny. Later. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.